The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Unfamiliar by Jerry Olshan. Shelby was trimming the roses in front of his new house when the dog attacked. He hadn't realized that's what it was doing at first. It was just a little mop of gray fur that bounced up and down with every shrill bark, and the way it lunged forward and darted back, he couldn't tell whether it was coming or going. Only when Shelby saw the snout full of needle-sharp teeth sticking out from under all that hair, did he know the dog was aimed at him. He burst out laughing. That sent the dog into an even wilder frenzy, barking nonstop and leaping into the air as if it would rip out its throat if only it could reach that high. "Hey," Shelby said. "Hey, cut it out. Go away." He brandished his pruning shears at it, but the dog merely danced out of range and kept barking. It had an anonymous overtone to its voice, a high-pitched squeak that pierced the ears like feedback through a microphone. Shelby stood up and looked over the low rose hedge. Nobody walked along the sidewalk. No cats moved down the street. Nobody was out in their yards. So where had the dog come from? And how had it gotten into his yard anyway? There was a picket fence all along the front of the roses and a gate at the walk. The little thing was too small to have jumped over. "Come on, shut up," Shelby said, a bit more sternly now. "Go home." He walked over and opened the gate for it. The dog stood its ground and barked. Shelby aimed a little kick at it, not even intending to hit it, just scare it off, but it growled a surprisingly deep growl, and its fur fluffed out until it looked twice as big as before. "Whoa, take it easy." Shelby backed up a step. How had it done that? It actually seemed bigger and much more ferocious than before. He watched in amazement as it shrank back down now that he wasn't threatening it anymore. Its voice even rose in pitch again. He bent down cautiously and tried the opposite approach. Somewhat timidly now, he stretched out his hand toward it and said, "Calm down already. Nobody's going to hurt you. Let's see if you've got a tag, okay?" The dog barked a few more times, but Shelby kept his hand outstretched, and it finally stopped. It edged forward, sniffed its finger, then jumped back and barked some more. "Oh, for crying out loud!" Shelby twitched his fingers as if he might have a treat for it. He wasn't much of a dog person. He had no idea if that would really work, but it was apparently the right thing to do. The dog came forward to sniff again, and this time it let him touch it, then scratch behind its ears. Its hair was soft, and its body felt warm when he got down to actual skin. Something, an air molecule on the nose maybe, set it off again a moment later, but Shelby had already felt that it wasn't wearing a collar. Well, once it got tired of barking at him, it would probably find its own way home. Shelby decided to give it that opportunity, so he took his pruning shears inside the house, leaving the front gate open for the dog to exit through. From the living room window, he watched it trot around the yard, peeing on rose bushes, the ash tree, and the gate post. He rattled the door when it hesitated in the open gateway, but instead of running off, it trotted up the walk and barked at the door. Shelby opened it and shouted, "Go away! but the dog darted between his feet and pranced into the living room as if it lived there. Maybe it did, Shelby thought. He had only owned the house for a week. The previous owner, a widow in her 90s, had died of old age, and her only living relative, a nephew who lived in France, had put the house up for sale through a local real estate agency without even coming to look at it. It would be easy enough to find out if she had had a dog. The neighbors would know. The woman had apparently been a recluse, but something this yappy wouldn't be easy to miss, even if she kept it inside most of the time. Shelby watched it jump up on his couch. The real estate agent had auctioned off all the furniture that had been in the house and all the woman's other possessions as well, but that didn't seem to affect the dog any. It turned around a couple of times and settled down on the right-hand cushion, looking more like a fuzzy pillow than a dog. He'd been about to chase it out, but he supposed this was as good a place for it as any, at least until he figured out whose it was. It didn't look like it would do any harm on the couch, so he left it there and went over to the neighbors on his left. He hadn't met them yet, but they were usually home during the day, and today was no exception. The husband, a big man in his 60s or so, answered the door. "Hi," he said. "You're the new guy. I'm Bill. Welcome to the neighborhood." He held out his right hand. Shelby realized his hands were still scratched and dirty from pruning roses. Sorry, he said, holding up his right hand to show why he didn't shake. "I'm Shelby. I was out in my yard just now, and this dog came by. Little gray mop dog. It seems to think it lives in my house. I was wondering if you knew who it belonged to." The neighbor scratched his head through his white crew cut. "Gray mop dog? Nope, don't remember seeing one of them around here. And I know Marlene didn't have a dog. Hang on a sec." He turned his head and shouted into the house. "Honey, you know anybody around here with a little gray dog?" His wife, also white-haired and smiling, came to the door and said, "No, I don't." She proceeded to tell Shelby about every dog in the neighborhood, and from there she delved into the children, and she was well into the parents' lives before Shelby heard barking from inside his house and said, "Sounds like maybe he wants out now. I'd better go." He was too late. The dog had apparently gotten up from the couch the moment he left, because it would have needed all the time it had to trash out his living room so thoroughly. Books had been pulled from bookcases, chairs had been tipped over, the computer keyboard and mouse dangled off the edge of the table by their cords, and the ultimate insult waited right square in the middle of the carpet, a glistening pile of wet brown dog poop. Amazingly large for such a small animal, and stinking up the entire room. "Oh, my dog!" Shelby shouted when he saw what it had done. "Out!" He kicked at it for real this time, caught it with the side of his foot, and scooted it toward the door. It growled its oddly ferocious growl and started to fluff up again, but Shelby reached over and flung open the screen door, then booted it right on outside. It stood on the step, barking frantically to get back in, but he slammed the screen and the main door as well. It kept on barking while he cleaned up the pile. When he opened the back door to go toss them in the dumpster, the dog raced around the house and tried to get in that way, but Shelby snatched up a broom by the door and held it at bay while he disposed of the mess. He actually had to whack it on the head to make it back off for him to get into his house again. It swelled up to amazing proportions, and its menacing growl sent shivers up his spine. He laughed, but it was a nervous laugh. Besieged by a lap dog, it would be hilarious if it wasn't happening to him. He spent the next half hour trying to ignore it while he cleaned up his living room. The dog barked for the first few minutes, then quieted down and scratched at the door a while. Then, just as Shelby was about to call the animal control center, it quit. He looked out the windows, careful not to show more of himself than he had to, lest the dog see him, and renewed its efforts, but he couldn't see it anywhere. He wondered if he should go outside and close the gate, but he decided to wait a while. The dog might still be in his yard, hiding next to the house or something. Shelby would give it plenty of time to get bored and wander off. Besides, the gate hadn't kept it out the first time. He'd have to go look for holes in the fence tomorrow. The dog stayed quiet for a couple of hours, but after dark, when Shelby was just settling in for an evening's reading, it started barking again. He slapped his Stephen King novel down on the coffee table, went over to the bar between the living room and the kitchen where he kept the phone, and looked up the animal control center in the book. When he dialed their number, though, all he got was a recording. It was after business hours. "Try again tomorrow. In an emergency, please call the veterinary hospital or the police." He felt foolish calling the police about a barking dog. To heck with it. He could put up with it for one night and call the pound in the morning if it was still hanging around. He sat back down in his living room and tried to read again. But the constant barking was so distracting, he couldn't make sense of the words. He switched on the TV and watched a documentary on sharks, but even with the volume up, he could hear the lunatic dog outside the whole time. He was about to try earplugs when the dog burst into an even wilder frenzy of barking, and a few seconds later, there was a timid knock on the door. He went to open it, saw his white-haired neighbor Bill standing on the step, the dog nipping at his heels. "You found out who owns it?" Shelby asked hopefully. Bill shook his head. "Wish I had. I'm afraid I came over to ask if you could maybe let it in for the night. It's keeping the whole neighborhood awake." "It tore up my living room last time I let it in," Shelby said. "Yeah, well, I'd offer to take it, but Phyllis is allergic. We've got to do something, though." Shelby thought it was pretty charitable of the guy to say "we," but it was pretty clear he meant "you," even so. The dog was, after all, barking on Shelby's doorstep. "I guess I should call the cops," Shelby said. "Cops, huh?" said his neighbor. "You haven't lived here long, have you? Unless there's drugs involved or somebody's being murdered, you might as well forget the cops. They'll never show up for a barking dog." Shelby nodded. He figured as much. That was the part of the reason why he hadn't called. It seemed so insignificant. He clearly had to do something, though. He could see faces in the windows across the street as other neighbors checked out the commotion in his yard. Great. He was going to get a reputation as a troublemaker right from the start. There was no winning this one. Sighing, Shelby opened the door, and the dog shot inside and rushed into the middle of the living room, where it continued to bark, jumping up and down as it did. "Thanks," Bill said, turning to go. "Do me a favor and ask across the street before you go home, would you?" Shelby asked him. "See if somebody might have a visitor or something he belongs to." Bill hesitated, clearly wishing he could just go home. But at last he nodded and said, "Sure. Okay." "There," Shelby thought as he closed the door. At least more of the neighbors would learn the story and not blame him for the noise. He turned to the dog, which stopped barking when it saw it had its attention. "You're a pain in the butt, you know that, little dog?" It hung its head and whimpered, a comical gesture of appeasement, except Shelby didn't believe for a second that there was enough brain in its head to entertain the concept. "I guess you need a name," he told it. "Not that a name means I'm going to keep you, understand?" He rubbed his chin, thinking, then said, "I think I'll call you Lunch, just so you won't get the wrong idea." He supposed Lunch might need lunch itself, and probably water, too, especially if it had been last long. So he went into the kitchen and got a cereal bowl, filled it from the tap, and set it on the floor. Lunch sniffed at it, barked at it a time or two, and then lapped the water. "I don't have any dog food," he said. He opened the refrigerator and looked for something a dog might eat. Leftover pizza? Why not? He set a slice on a plate and microwaved it for a few seconds, then put it down on the floor. Lunch sniffed, backed, then turned away and went back into the living room. "Fine," Shelby told it. "It'll be there when you get hungry, cold and slimy, but it'll be there." The dog trotted right to the couch and settled down on the same cushion it had curled up on before. Shelby watched it for a moment, waiting for it to go berserk and tear up his living room again. But it lowered its head to its paws and stared back at him from under its bushy brows. Shelby backed away down the hall, keeping his eye on the dog until he got to the door to the spare bedroom. He hadn't moved much of his stuff into it yet. He hurriedly hauled what few boxes he had put in there back out again. Then he spread newspaper all across the carpet and brought in the pizza and the water. The dog itself proved problematic, growling softly when Shelby reached for it, but he wasn't about to let it run loose in his house all night. He petted it for a minute, then gently picked it up and carried it into the bedroom. It felt heavier than he'd expected. Maybe it wasn't all fur after all. "Here you go," he told it. "Home for the night. If you need anything, don't bother to ask, okay?" He set the dog down and quickly closed the door. It immediately started barking again, but he shouted through the door at it, "Shut up, dog, or I'll name you Midnight Snack." That actually did the trick. It whimpered a time or two, and Shelby heard it walking around on the newspaper. But after a minute or so, he heard a rustle and a thump as it settled down. He tiptoed away to his own bedroom and got ready for bed himself. Of course, it was too good to last. In the middle of the night, Shelby reached groggily for the clock and saw that it was past 2 a.m. He heard ferocious barking from the spare bedroom, barking that grew deeper in pitch with every breath, and then a loud crash and the sound of splintering wood. "Damn it, dog, what now?" Shelby threw off the covers and stalked into the hall in his shorts, switched on the light, and stared in shock at the door that had been ripped to shreds. It had exploded outward, the bottom half of it forced right past the jamb by some incredible force. Pieces of veneer still swayed back and forth from whatever had done it. The whatever had to be lunch. Shelby heard its throaty growl coming from the living room now. He slipped back into his own bedroom, snatched up the baseball bat that he kept by his bed for protection, and walked cautiously down the hallway with it cocked back, ready to swing. "Lunch?" he called softly. "What's the matter, boy?" "Call him off," a panicked voice shouted. "Call him off." Shelby flipped on the living room light and saw a man dressed all in black with a full-face stocking cap over his head backed into the corner between the living room and the kitchen bar by. He blinked a few times to make sure he was really seeing okay. The creature hardly resembled a dog. It had long gray hair all over its body, and it stood on four legs, but it was as big as a grizzly bear. Its jaws looked big enough to crack an elephant femur, and the creature looked eager to try them out on the man in black. "Lunch?" Shelby asked again. "Lunch, dinner, whatever you like. I'll even pick up the tab," the intruder said quickly. "Just call him off." "That's his name," Shelby explained, then not expecting to do any good. But because he had a strange man and an even stranger dog in his home, and he felt the need to take command of the situation somehow, he said, "Heel, boy, just hold him there." Incredibly, Lunch backed up a step and growled again deep in his massive throat. Shelby kept his bat cocked back. He felt ridiculous standing there in his shorts with a slavering were-creature and a masked robber in his living room. Ridiculous and scared, but not as scared as the other guy, whose eyes never left Lunch. He backed up a step. I think I'll be going now." "Oh, no, you don't. You just stay right there while I call the cops and we'll..." "The cops?" The man seemed even more startled by that than by Lunch. "You burst into my house in the middle of the night? Of course I'm going to call the cops. What did you expect?" "I..." The man scratched his forehead through the right eye hole in his mask. "To tell you the truth, I was hoping to find the place empty. At the worst, I thought I might find somebody new here, but I hoped I could do my business and be gone without waking him up. I didn't expect to find her familiar still here. Her familiar? Shelby knew what a familiar was. He had just never learned they might actually exist, or that he'd have one in his own house, holding an intruder at bay. But there was no arguing with a creature the size of the one that drooled messily on his floor right in front of him, or with the guy in black who carried a big knife and a scabbard at his waist, now that Shelby looked closer. Maybe old Lunch wasn't as bad to have around as he'd thought. The man in black sighed and pulled off his face mask. He looked to be about 40 and very, very tired. I should have known she wouldn't let it go, even when she died. Damn, I'm screwed. You might as well just stick him on me and get it over with. Lunch edged forward as if he liked that idea. But Shelby said, back. Screwed how? What's going on? You really don't know? All I know is that this dog showed up today and wouldn't go away, and now you're here. I assume that's more than just a coincidence. Probably. I wouldn't put it past her to keep some kind of snoop on me. Probably knew I was coming the moment I knew it myself. Shelby was growing tired of standing there with his bat over his shoulder and asking dumb questions. How about you just hand me that knife real gentle-like and tell me what this is all about, he said. The man unsnapped the leather scabbard and withdrew the knife with two fingers, holding it out cautiously by the blade, while Lunch growled at him. Lunch's voice sounded like a diesel locomotive in a tunnel now. Shelby took the knife in his left hand, then stood back and lowered his bat. Talk, he said. The man swallowed. It's a long story. I'm not exactly proud of it either. I stole something of hers once. You know what a grimoire is? Spellbook, Shelby said. Yeah, so you do know about this sort of thing. I've read about it, Shelby said. I don't practice. He almost laughed. He'd never, until tonight, believed it was even possible. Neither do I, but the guy who hired me did, and so did the woman who used to live here. He wanted her grimoire. I got it for him, too, and she cursed me for it. How? What did she do to you? She. You're going to think I'm nuts. Mind if I go ahead and show you? What are you going to do? Just pick up a book. You got one you don't particularly care about? Shelby narrowed his eyes. What was this guy going to do with it? He looked at his shelves full of books, books he never loaned out because he didn't want them to come back to him with broken spines or dog-eared pages. Then he saw the telephone book on the bar between the kitchen and the living room, just to the right of the intruder. That would do. And it was big enough and floppy enough that the guy couldn't use it for a weapon. There, he said, pointing with the knife. The phone book. Right. The man picked it up, opened it in the middle, and held it in his hands as if he were going to read it. The two open pages burst into flame. Lunch growled and lunged forward. Heel, Shelby yelled, and the dog reluctantly backed off. The man in black slapped the phone book closed, sniffing out the flames and spewing ash out in front of him, then set it back on the counter. I can't read a book, he said. The moment I open it up, the pages catch fire. Wow, Shelby said. Wow? I can't read a dang word, and you say wow? Look, pal, I was in college when she laid this on me. That was 20 years ago. I was going to be a journalist. I heard about this occult group in town and thought I'd get a cool story out of it. And the next thing I know, I'm flunking out because I couldn't keep a job because I kept starting fires every time I tried to read a manual. And even when I finally did work that didn't require reading, I couldn't balance my checkbook. I forget reading for pleasure. If it weren't for billboards and books on tape, I'd be a basket case. Sorry, Shelby said. He really was. The idea of not being able to read scared him more than anything else he'd seen that night. So what were you hoping to do here? They auctioned off all of her stuff before I got the house. I know. I bought the whole dang load of it. bunch of crap, too. I spent the last 3 weeks going through all of it for the talisman that keeps the spell active, but it wasn't there, so I figured it had to be in the house. Is it? I don't know. Your dang familiar nabbed me the minute I came in the window. Oh, back off, Lunch. The slavering creature stepped backward, muscles rippling along its flanks and legs as it moved. Bear in mind that I'll turn him loose the moment you make a wrong move, Shelby told the man, sounding a good deal more confident than he felt, but go ahead and look around. The man sidled carefully around Lunch, looking at the living room. The place was completely bare when you moved in, he asked. Bare and freshly painted. They even had the attic cleaned out and re-insulated, so there's nothing up there either. It's got to be here, though. Maybe under the floor or in the walls or... His voice trailed off as he held his hands out in front of him, then slowly turned full circle. I can feel it, he said. He stepped over to the bookcase beside the couch. Here. No, that's mine. Behind it, then. He swept his hands around in a circle in front of the shelves and said, Oh, yeah, they're tingling like mad right here. It's big. He waved his arms some more, slowly outlining a shape in the air, a five-pointed star. Pentagram, Shelby said. Sure looks like it. Here, help me move the bookcase. Shelby hesitated. What if this guy was lying to him? He'd seen the pages in the phone book burst into flame, sure, but that didn't necessarily mean the rest of it was true. Lunch growled as if suddenly troubled by Shelby's doubts. There wasn't much arguing with him, at least. Something weird was definitely going on, and this guy had the best explanation Shelby had heard yet. He tossed the knife down the hallway to get it out of the way in case there was a struggle, and keeping the baseball bat, he walked over to the bookshelf. And together he and the intruder wiggled it out from the wall. This is it, the guy said, running his hands over the blank white space. She drew a pentagram here, and they just painted over it. So what do we do to turn it off? Shelby asked. I haven't got a clue. Shelby turned to the dog. Lunch? Lunch barked. A Rottweiler would have wet itself hearing it. Shush! The neighbors already hate me. He turned back to the wall and said to the man in black, Stand back. What are you going to do? Well, they talk about breaking a spell. Let's see if it's a literal expression. Shelby swung the bat at the wall. He was appalled that he would even think of doing such a thing to his own house. But the night had grown so strange that smashing a wall seemed minor to what had already happened. His whole arm vibrated when the bat hit. But a crack appeared in the pebbly surface. Shelby swung harder and knocked a chunk of plaster loose this time. A dark line ran through it. Three more swings and he could see a couple legs of the pentagram. He smashed at them again and again until they were completely obliterated. A crackling sound filled the air. Blue light flashed out from the wall, leaving after images in Shelby's eyes, and a howl like a jet engine shook the room. For a moment it seemed as if the house might actually lift off, but the shaking subsided, and that howl slowly dropped in pitch as the source of the sound swirled up through the roof and out into the night. Shelby lowered his bat. Too strange, but here, he said, picking a book at random from the case they had just moved and tossed it to the man. He opened it up, and Shelby saw he had picked Firestarter. Oops. But the book didn't burst into flame when the man looked at the pages. I can read it, he said. I can read it. Go ahead and borrow it, Shelby told him. But be sure you don't break the spine, and the man set it down as if he had just grown fangs. I'll buy my own copy. He laughed a hysterical laugh. By God, I'll march right into a bookstore and buy my own copy. He turned toward the window and looked back to Shelby. Thank you, he said. Don't mention it, Shelby said. You want to use the door? Oh, sure. Look, I'll pay for the wall. Forget it. Let's just scoot the shelf back over the hole and call it a night. They did that, and then the man left by the front door, still thanking Shelby profusely. Lunch had already begun to shrink again. The familiar was down to collie size now, but the man refrained from petting it on his way out. Shelby closed the door behind him, then turned to watch the rest of the transformation back into a furry mop dog. "Okay," he said. "I guess you were just doing your job, but now you can go back to wherever you came from. I don't think that guy will be back." Lunch just jumped up and down and barked. Shelby sat down on the couch and surveyed his house. The spare bedroom door was a total loss, and there was a pile of plaster fragments and dust around the base of the bookcase. Otherwise, he had gotten off pretty easy for his first brush with magic. And apparently he had a familiar now, too. He shook his head. It was really, really late. He didn't think he could sleep after all that had happened, but he leaned back on the couch and closed his eyes, and a few minutes later proved himself wrong. In the morning, he saw that Lunch had been busy. Books lay scattered everywhere. Shelby's running shoes had been chewed to little plastic shreds, and another pile of dog lay in the middle of them all. "Lunch!" Shelby yelled. The dog skittered into the living room from the kitchen, a Chips Ahoy sack over his head. Shelby laughed, but he got up and went to the kitchen divider, where he opened the phone book, thanking his luck that the scorched part was at the end of the white pages, and called the animal control center. The woman who answered the phone promised to send someone right out, but when he gave her the address, she said, "Oh, that dog. You know it? I heard it last night. I live just down the street from you." She laughed. "Don't worry. I'll find it a good home myself." Then she lowered her voice and said, "You're new to the neighborhood." It wasn't a question. "That's right," Shelby admitted. "Well, I'm throwing a party next Saturday for the rest of Marlene's, special interest group. Since you live in her house now, maybe you should come and meet us." Shelby's heart thudded hard against his chest. He swallowed, then said, "Is there any more of her unfinished business that I should know about?" His neighbor laughed again. "With Marlene, you never know. But if there is, we'll take care of it." "Wonderful," Shelby said. "I mean, thank you. That would be good." He got her name and address and promised to be there on Saturday. He was relieved to learn that they met at 7, not midnight. After he hung up, he looked back at Lunch, who had managed to pull the cookie sack off and was looking at him with his head cocked to the side in the classically cute pose that little animals do so well. He looked so contrite that Shelby momentarily reconsidered keeping him, but only for a moment. Lunch might be cute. He might have helped Shelby to meet his neighbors. He might even be a supernatural guardian. But he was still a royal pain in the butt, and Shelby was not a dog person. The Wish by Roald Dahl. Under the palm of one hand, the child became aware of the scab of an old cut on his kneecap. He bent forward to examine it closely. A scab was always a fascinating thing. It presented a special challenge he was never able to resist. "Yes," he thought, "I will pick it off, even if it isn't ready, even if the middle of it sticks, even if it hurts like anything." With a fingernail, he began to explore cautiously around the edges of the scab. He got a nail underneath it, and when he raised it, but ever so slightly, it suddenly came off. The whole hard brown scab came off beautifully, leaving an interesting little circle of smooth red skin. "Nice, very nice indeed." He rubbed the circle, and it didn't hurt. He picked up the scab, put it on his thigh, and flipped it with a finger so that it flew away and landed on the edge of the carpet, the enormous red and black and yellow carpet that stretched the whole length of the hall from the stairs on which he sat to the front door in the distance. A tremendous carpet, bigger than the tennis lawn, much bigger than that. He regarded it gravely, setting his eyes upon it with mild pleasure. He had never really noticed it before, but now, all of a sudden, the colors seemed to brighten mysteriously and spring out at him in a most dazzling way. "You see," he told himself, "I know how it is. The red parts of the carpet are red-hot lumps of coal. What I must do is this. I must walk all the way along it to the front door without touching them. If I touch the red, I will be burnt. As a matter of fact, I will be burnt up completely. And the black parts of the carpet, yes, the black parts, are snakes, poisonous snakes, adders mostly, and cobras, thick like tree trunks round the middle. If I touch one of them, I'll be bitten and I'll die before tea time. And if I get across safely without being burnt and without being bitten, I will be given a puppy for my birthday tomorrow." He got to his feet and climbed higher up the stairs to obtain a better view of this vast tapestry of color and death. Was it possible? Was there enough yellow? Yellow was the only color he was allowed to walk on. Could it be done? This was not a journey to be undertaken lightly. The risks were far too great for that. The child's face, a fringe of white gold hair, two large blue eyes, a small pointed chin, peered down anxiously over the banisters. The yellow was a bit thin in places, and there were one or two wildish gaps. But it did seem to go all the way along to the other end. For someone who had only yesterday triumphantly traveled the whole length of the brick path from the stables to the summer house without touching the cracks, this carpet thing should not be too difficult. Except for the snakes. The mere thought of snakes sent a fine electricity of fear running like pins down the backs of his legs and under the soles of his feet. He came slowly down the stairs and advanced to the edge of the carpet. He extended one small sandaled foot and placed it cautiously upon a patch of yellow. Then he brought the other foot up, and there was just enough room for him to stand with the 2 feet together. There, he had started. His bright oval face was curiously intent, a shade whiter perhaps than before, and he was holding his arms out sideways to assist his balance. He took another step, lifting his foot high over a patch of black, aiming carefully with his toe for a narrow channel of yellow on the other side. When he had completed the second step, he paused to rest, standing very stiff and still. The narrow channel of yellow ran forward unbroken for at least 5 yards, and he advanced gingerly along it bit by bit, as though walking a tightrope. Where it finally curled off sideways, he had to take another long stride, this time over a vicious-looking mixture of black and red. Halfway across, he began to wobble. He waved his arms round wildly, windmill fashion, to keep his balance, and he got safely across and rested again on the other side. He was quite breathless now, and so tense. He stood high on his toes all the time, arms out sideways, fists clenched. He was on a big, safe island of yellow. There were lots of room on it. He couldn't possibly fall off. And he stood there, resting, hesitating, waiting, wishing he could stay forever on this big, safe yellow island, but the fear of not getting the puppy compelled him to go on. Step by step, he edged further ahead, and between each one, he paused to decide exactly where he should put his foot. Once he had a choice of ways, either to left or right, and he chose the left, because although it seemed the more difficult, there was not so much black in that direction. The black was what had made him nervous. He glanced quickly over his shoulder to see how far he had come, nearly halfway. There could be no turning back now. He was in the middle, and he couldn't turn back, and he couldn't jump off sideways either, because it was too far, And when he looked at all the red and all the black that lay ahead of him, he felt that old, sudden, sickening surge of panic in his chest, like last Easter time, that afternoon when he got lost all alone in the darkest part of Piper's Wood. He took another step, placing his foot carefully upon the only little piece of yellow within reach, and this time the point of the foot came within a centimeter of some black. It wasn't touching the black. He could see it wasn't touching. He could see the small line of yellow separating the toe of his sandal from the black. But the snake stirred as though sensing his nearness and raised its head and gazed at the foot with bright beady eyes, watching to see if it was going to touch. "I'm not touching you. You mustn't bite me. You know I'm not touching you." Another snake slid up noiselessly beside the first, raised its head, two heads now, two pairs of eyes staring at the foot, gazing at a little naked place just below the sandal strap where the skin showed through. The child went high up on his toes and stayed there, frozen stiff with terror. It was minutes before he dared to move again. The next step would have to be a really long one. There was this deep, curling river of black that ran clear across the width of the carpet, and he was forced by his position to cross it at its widest part. He thought first of trying to jump it, but decided he couldn't be sure of landing accurately on the narrow band of yellow on the other side. He took a deep breath, lifted one foot, and inch by inch he pushed it out in front of him, far, far out, then down and down, until at last the tip of his sandal was across and resting safely on the other edge of the yellow. He leaned forward, transferring his weight to his front foot. Then he tried to bring the back foot up as well. He strained and pulled and jerked his body, but the legs were too wide apart, and he couldn't make it. He tried to get back again. He couldn't do that either. He was doing the splits, and he was properly stuck. He glanced down and saw this deep, curling river of black underneath him. Parts of it were stirring now and uncoiling and beginning to shine with a dreadfully oily glister. He wobbled, waved his arms frantically to keep his balance, but that seemed to make it worse. He was starting to go over. He was going over to the right quite slowly. He was going over, then faster and faster. And at the last moment, instinctively, he put out a hand to break the fall. And the next thing he saw was this bare hand of his going right into the middle of a great glistening mass of black. And he gave one piercing cry as it touched. Outside in the sunshine, far away behind the house, the mother was looking for her son. Prairie Godmother by Daniel Marcus. Sometimes it got so bad the only thing Will could do was put a 12-pack of Budweiser in the old 4x4, some Hank Williams on the tape machine, and burn up the two-lane straight as the caterpillars roll out into the empty heart of the prairie. He wasn't a drinking man, not really, but it kind of built up in him slowly, that hollow feeling. Like he was one of those dried Indian gourds and there was nothing inside him but a handful of tiny, rattling seeds, hard as stones. It was more than just missing Rose, although, of course, he did miss her. Every day, even after 5 years, Will still slept alone under the bedspread she'd made for them with her own small hands, and her needlepoint, Lord's Prayer, still hung on the living room wall right over the television. No, it was more like when she died, it left a space in him that never filled, and these trips were like the wind rushing in to claim it. He was well out of Salina now, coming up on the intersection with County 7. Will reached over to the carton on the seat next to him, pried out a beer, and pulled the top up one-handed as he turned onto the little back blacktop road and pulled It stretched ahead of him, winking in and out of sight with the gentle contours of the land, and Will felt it pulling him forward like a wire to some place beyond the low distant hills. Hank was singing, "I'm so lonesome I could cry," and Will crooned along with him, belting out the words loud in the cab of the pickup. He caught a glimpse of himself in the rear view, his leathery face scrunched up like he'd caught his foot in a door. He laughed, and he felt the borders of that darkness in him push back a little farther. "You just keep doing it for me, Hank. Just don't stop talking to me." Will loved the prairie, everything about it. When you looked at it from a distance, it looked smooth and featureless, just miles and miles of tall waving grasses. But when you got up close, you could see the wrinkles and scars and scars. There was a rolling motion to the land that was gentle on the eye but sucked the strength out of you on foot, and the contours hid a cross-hatched pattern of steam beds and hidden arroyos. A person could get lost out here and never get found. Will had a favorite spot, and that's where he was headed. He turned onto a rutted dirt road that snaked around a low hill, and when the road widened just a bit, he pulled over and stopped. He put the beers in a rucksack along with a couple of ham sandwiches neatly wrapped in wax paper and walked straight out into the waist-high grass, following the faint path. The land gradually fell, and as it did, the grass got higher and higher until it was over his head, and Will felt like he was walking at the bottom of an ocean of rustling tan. Suddenly, the high grass opened up in front of him, and he stood on the edge of a dry stream bed. Rocks of all sizes were scattered in the shallow bed, ranging from stones no bigger than a baby's fist to huge, rough boulders the size of a Buick. There was a cluster of big ones downstream a bit, just above a fork in the bed. One of them had a flat, sloping surface perfect for sitting, and Will picked his way toward it, stepping from one stone to another along the rough stream bed as if water still flowed between them. He dropped the rucksack and sat down next to it, wincing with the familiar protest in his knees and back. "Won't be able to do this for much longer," he thought, and shook his head. He reached into the rucksack and pulled out another beer and a sandwich. He unwrapped the sandwich, carefully refolded the wax paper into a nice, tight, neat square, and returned it to the pack. He took a big bite and followed it with a long pull of beer. It was so good. The sharp, salty taste of the ham, the cool bitterness of the brew, it almost brought tears to his eyes. He sat there drinking and eating, not really thinking about anything. Will liked the way the forks of the stream bed ran off in front of him, gradually diverging, separated by a widening V of tall, waving grass. It was getting on to his favorite time of day, late afternoon, the heat coming up out of the ground in waves and the slanted golden light of the sun just beginning to lose its harsh midday edge. He wished there was someone around to share it with, and he felt a small surge of sadness wash through him. Rose. They'd tried to have kids, but it just didn't happen. After a few years of disappointment and a cold growing fear, they took her in for some tests. "Her equipment's in tip-top condition," the doctor said. Rose was still in the examination room getting dressed. Will didn't like his false heartiness or the cold, limp handshake he'd proffered. "If I were you," he continued, "I'd see about getting a sperm count myself." Will was quick to anger in those days, and he almost took a poke at the clean, smug face hovering above the stethoscope-colored jacket, like a pale boon. Instead, he nodded sharply and muttered something, and when his wife emerged from the room, he took her arm and hustled her out of there like they were late for something important. They drove home in silence. About halfway there, when they were sitting at a stoplight, Will turned to her. "They don't know what's wrong," he heard himself saying. "They don't know what the problem is. We could get some more tests, but I don't know how much good it'd do." Her eyes filled up with tears, but she took his hand. "We'll just have to keep trying, Will. Something's gotta happen sooner or later. He turned away and put both hands on the steering wheel, waiting for the light to change. On his own, without telling Rose, he went to another doctor and had his own tests done. Sure enough, all those years he'd been shooting blanks. He'd worked the machine shop at Rocky Flats for a few years back in the 60s, and that must have done it. They'd handed out some safety pamphlets, comic books, really. Will remembered the stylized logos stamped across the front of the gaudy covers, the looping crossed ellipses of the electron orbits framing a round smiling face where the nucleus was supposed to be. Andy the Atom. The pamphlets made radiation sound safe as shuffleboard. Just take a few simple precautions and you'll be fine. Will never told her. He waited for years for the cancer to take him, like it took so many of his friends from the plant. But it got her instead. He never told her. Now she was gone, and it was too late to take back it. His stupid pride. Too late. He upended the beer, draining out the last few drops, and put the empty in the rucksack, smiling to himself a little as he heard it rattle against the growing collection of empties. We're getting there, he thought, feeling no pain. As he was reaching around in the rucksack for another full one, he heard a low whistling sound coming from out of the western sky, getting louder. He looked up, and his mouth fell open. The beer slipped out of his hands and rolled down off the rock, bursting open with an explosive hiss when it hit the stream bed. It came in low, about 100 feet above the prairie. It was long and thin. A featureless ellipsoid about the size of a jetliner, a dull metallic black. It seemed to suck the waning afternoon light into itself like a sponge, and it was burning. It passed over Will's head with a roar that nearly burnt his eardrums, trailing a wake of oily-looking smoke, and went down somewhere beyond a low grassy hill about a quarter mile away. Will tensed, waiting for an explosion. But none came. What the hell was that thing, he wondered. Maybe something new out of the SAC base up at Omaha. He'd heard plenty of stories, and the pictures he'd seen of the new B-1 bomber looked like something out of a science fiction movie. Even if the dang thing couldn't fly, a part of him knew, though, that this thing was just too strange, even for SAC. It didn't have any wings, for one thing, and the way it held the light, kind of rippling, almost disappearing when you looked right at it. Will laughed out loud and shook his head. A spaceship. Little green men. Boy, howdy, Will. Have another beer. Still, he couldn't tell how hard the thing went down. There might be someone hurt. He slung the rucksack over his shoulder, headed down the left fork of the stream bed. A wisp of smoke curled up beyond the hill, marking the spot. He was a little drunk, and he stumbled a couple of times on the uneven ground. He wasn't scared, not exactly, but he felt mixed up. A part of him was putting one foot in front of the other, pushing him forward, wanting nothing but to be there to help if someone was in need. Another part of him, though, way down deep, wanted to turn trail and run like hell. As he neared the spot, the breeze brought him a sharp metallic burn, wiring sort of smell, and underneath it the familiar odor of burning grass. They'd had some rain recently, so hopefully it wouldn't catch. Will had seen a prairie fire once, and that was enough. As he got closer, the feeling of unease intensified. Still, he kept walking, one step at a time, one foot in front of the other, like inching. Will thought, scared but showing up. He climbed up out of the stream bed and started pushing through the waist-high grass. A smoky haze hung in the air. Suddenly he came to a wide swath of flattened grass and torn earth. Patches of fire licked feebly here and there, but they were well separated and looked like they wouldn't last long. He looked down the length of the swath and could make out a shape a couple of 100 yards away, partially hidden by the hazy smoke. This ain't no Air Force stealth gizmo on a training run, he thought. He wished suddenly for the Remington sitting in his gun rack back in the pickup. The smoke was starting to get him. His eyes stung, and there was a raw, rasping pain in his throat. Still, he had to keep going, ignoring the clenching fear in his stomach and the protesting ache in his bones. He began to run down the corridor of ruined earth toward the thing, picking his way between the fires. It materialized out of the haze, almost as if drawing substance from the smoke itself, a huge black shape. It lay in a patch of scorched earth, crumpled and broken. A wide scar ran down one side, splitting it open, and Will caught glimpses of flickering lights through the smoke. He stopped, trying to catch his breath. He drew in a great lungful of air and smoke, and he doubled over in a spasm of coughing. He felt something, a kind of tugging at the edge of his mind. Here, it seemed to say. I am here. But it wasn't really words. That was put just the best way Will's mind could get hold of it. It was more like a kind of knowing, and was also in that knowing that Will realized stubbornly he had nothing to fear. He approached the crippled ship. Near the tear in its side, half hidden by the curved, crumpled fuselage, lay a human form. Will ran closer and saw with a shock that he was almost right. It had a rounded body covered in folds of metallic-looking cloth and the right number of arms and legs, but the face was like nothing Will had ever seen before. Blue, scaly skin stretched tight across a triangular jaw. A lipless mouth revealed thin, needle-like teeth, and there was a single vertical slit where the nose was supposed to be. Narrow, bony ridges protruded above wide, golden eyes that held Will's own in an intense stare. A thin line of dark blood ran out of the corner of its mouth. Red, Will thought. Red blood. He felt strangely calm. He knelt down next to the creature, reached out a hand, then pulled it back. He didn't know what to do. The creature opened its mouth and made a sound from deep in its throat, like the last gulp of water emptying from a jug. It sounded like, "Gug." Will spread his hands. "I don't, gug," it said again, more forcefully this time. It pulled aside a fold of its silvery garment to reveal a scaly pocket of skin along its midriff, rippling and bunching like there was something moving around down there. Suddenly, a head popped up through the leathery flap. The same triangular face, the same big golden eyes. "God damn it," Will said. He felt it again, that contact, a feather touch on the surface of his mind. Will didn't hear it in words, but he knew that this creature was dying, that it wanted him to save its child. He also knew somehow that they could live here, that their bodies weren't really all that different. And he knew, without that voice telling him so, that they weren't all that different as souls either, that they moved to the dictates of something that was larger than themselves, something like love. It was enough for Will. "Come on, little feller." Will reached down, and the thing crawled out of its pocket and swarmed up his arms. "Go." He felt that touch in his mind again, but it was pushing this time. "Go. Leave. Go." The voice was still powerful, even though Will could see the life beginning to flicker and fade in the thing's eyes. He took a last look, nodded sharply, and began to run back along the corridor of burned, flattened grass, the child thing clinging tightly to his arms. When they were back at the stream bed about a half mile away, the ground lit up like a flashbulb had gone off, and Will felt a wash of radiant heat on the back of his neck. He could feel the presence of that voice in his mind wink out like a light being turned off. The creature in his arms made a whimpering sound and burrowed more tightly into his chest. He turned around. A small mushroom cloud rose up in the darkening sky. "Destroying the evidence," Will thought. "Smart lizard." He looked down. The thing was curled up against his chest, and all he could see was the top of its head. A pattern of fine scales caught highlights in the waning light. "So what the hell am I going to do with you?" he asked. "And what am I supposed to call you?" He shook his head, then laughed out loud. "Sure. Yeah, why not?" He thought maybe he'd name it Hank.